Chapter 29. A Terrible Feeling.
"What is Perrin plotting, do you think?" Berylaine asked, as she strolled beside Fail and Alejandra. Fail didn't answer. The late afternoon was softly lit by a distant sun shrouded in clouds. Soon it would make the horizon burn as it sank down for the night. In 2 days, Perrin would go on trial. He'd delayed specifically, she knew, to gain more time for the Ashaman to work out the strange problem with gateways. Their army was growing, still more people flooding to them. Scout reports indicated that the White Cloak force was growing as well, more slowly but still growing. In days like these, an army was a symbol of strength and, at the very least, food. A stand of finger-root trees glutted themselves on the water of the stream near Perrin's war camp. Such strange plants they were, with those roots that dipped into the water. Trunks like flowing glass that had pooled while hardening. There was nothing like them up in Saldea. It seemed that two wrong steps here could lead you into a swamp.
"No answer for me?" Berylaine asked. She seemed distracted these days. "I've been thinking. Perhaps it would be good to send an envoy to the White Cloak army. Do you think Perrin would allow me to go and speak with them? Perhaps I could make a personal appeal on his behalf."
She kept bringing up that topic. "No," Fail said. "You know his mind is made up on this trial, Berylaine." The first pursed her lips, but did not press further. The three continued their walk, accompanied by 10 maidens. Once Fail might have complained about the attention. That was before she'd been taken so unexpectedly, and so easily. In the distance she saw a small group of refugees leaving the camp, walking away to the southeast, cross-country. Before things had gone wrong with the gateways, about 10,000 had been sent to rural areas in Kyrian. All had instructions to remain quiet. Perrin didn't want his location known yet. Women would be still, but of course the men would gossip. They always did. Few knew that gateways failed. Perrin had told the people that he needed the Ashaman strong in case there was fighting with the White Cloaks. It was true enough. Still, some refugees had asked to leave, going on foot. To these, Fail gave bits of gold or a jewel from Savannah's store and wished them the best. She was surprised at how many wanted to return to homes that were in Shanshan-controlled lands. Despite the departures, the size of Perrin's force was swelling day by day. Fail and the others passed a large group, practicing with swords. The refugees who had decided to train were now some 25,000 strong. They practiced late into the day, and Fail could still hear barked orders from Tom. "Well," Berylaine continued her musings, "what will Perrin do? Why set up this trial? He wants something from those White Cloaks." She stepped around a gnarled finger root. The first, like so many others, read much more into Perrin's actions than there was to find. He'd be amused if he knew the plots they ascribed to him. "And she claims to understand men," Fail thought. Perrin was by no means stupid, nor was he the simple man he sometimes claimed to be. He planned, he thought, and he was careful, but he was also direct, deliberate. When he said something, he meant it.
"I agree with Berylaine," Alejandra said. "We should just leave, march away, or attack those White Cloaks."
Fail shook her head. "It bothers Perrin when people think he did something wrong. As long as the White Cloaks continue to insist he is a murderer, his name will not be clear. He was being bull-headed and foolish, but there was a nobility about it. So long as it didn't get him killed. However, she loved him for that very sense of honor. Changing him would be ill-advised, and she had to make certain others didn't take advantage of him." As she always did when they discussed the White Cloaks, Berylaine got a strange look in her eyes, and she glanced, perhaps unconsciously, in the direction their army camped. Light. She wasn't going to ask again if she could go speak to them. She had come up with a dozen different reasons why she wanted to. Fael noticed a large group of soldiers trying to look inconspicuous as they rounded the inside of the camp, keeping pace with Fael and their guards on their promenade. Perrin wanted her well protected. "This young Lord Captain Commander," Eliandra said idly. "He looks quite striking in that white uniform, wouldn't you say? If you can get past that sunburst on his cloak. Such a beautiful man." "Oh," Berylaine said. Surprisingly, warm color rose in her cheeks. "I'd always heard that Morghese's stepson was a handsome man," Eliandra continued, "but I hadn't anticipated him being so pristine."
"Like a statue carved from marble," Berylaine whispered. "A relic from the Age of Legends. A perfect thing left behind for us to worship."
"He's passable," Fael said with a sniff. "I prefer a bearded face myself." It wasn't a lie. She loved a bearded face, and Perrin was handsome. He had a burly power to him that was quite appealing. But this Galad Damodred was... well, it wasn't fair to compare him to Perrin. That would be like comparing a stained glass window to a cabinet made by a master carpenter. Both were excellent examples of their craft, and it was hard to weigh them against one another. But the window certainly did shine. Berylaine's expression seemed distant. Yes, she had been taken by Damodred. Such a short time for it to have happened. Fael told Berylaine that finding another man for her attentions would help with the rumors, but the White Cloak Commander? Had the woman lost all sense? "So what do we do?" Eliandra asked as they rounded the south side of the camp, halfway to the point from which they'd started. "About the White Cloaks?" Fael asked. "About Megdin," Eliandra said. "Morghese. I can't help feeling that she took advantage of my kindness," Fael said. "After all we went through together, she didn't tell me who she was?"
"You seem to be determined to give her very little credit," Berylaine said.
Fael didn't reply. She'd been thinking about what Perrin said, and he was probably right. Fael should not be so angry with her. If Morghese really had been fleeing one of the Forsaken, it was a miracle that she was still alive. Besides, she herself had lied about who she was when first meeting Perrin. In truth, her anger was because Morghese was going to judge Perrin. She presumed to judge Perrin. Megdin, the lady's maid, might be grateful, but Morghese, the queen, would see Perrin as a rival. Would Morghese really treat this judgment fairly? Or would she take the chance to discredit a man who had raised himself up as a lord?
"I feel as you do, my lady," Eliandra said softly.
"And how is that?"
"Deceived," Eliandra said.
"Megdin was our friend. I thought I knew her."
"You would have acted exactly as she did in that situation," Berylaine said. "Why give away information if you don't have to?"
"Because we were friends," Eliandra said. "After what we went through together, it turns out she's Morghese Trachand. Not just a queen, the queen. The woman's a legend. And she was here, with us, serving tea, poorly." "You have to admit," Fael said thoughtfully, "she did get better with the tea." Fael reached to her throat, touching the cord that bore Roland's stone. She didn't wear it every day, but she did so often enough. Had Morghese been false that entire time they'd been with the Shido? Or had she, in a way, been more true? With no titles to live up to, she hadn't been forced to be the legendary Morghese Trachand. Under circumstances like that, wouldn't a person's true nature be more likely to show through? Fael gripped the cord. Morghese would not turn this trial against Perrin out of spite, but she would offer judgment in honesty, which meant Fayil needed to be prepared and have ready. Screams sounded nearby. Fayil reacted immediately, spinning toward the woods. She instinctively anticipated Aiel leaping from the bushes to kill and capture, and she felt a moment of sheer panic. But the screams were coming from inside camp. She cursed, turning about, but felt something tug at her belt. She looked down with a start to see her belt knife pull itself from its sheath and flip into the air. "A bubble of evil," Berylaine said, stumbling to the side. Fayil ducked, throwing herself to the ground as her knife flipped through the air toward her head. It narrowly missed. As Fayil came up in a crouch, she saw with a start that Berylaine was facing down a dagger, one that looked, from the damage to Berylaine's shirt, to have ripped its way free of a hidden sheath inside her sleeve. Beyond Berylaine, the camp was in a tumult. The nearby practicing refugees were scattering, swords and spears flipping through the air of their own volition. It looked as if every weapon in the camp had suddenly sprung to life, rising up to attack its master. Motion. Fayil dodged to the side as her knife came back for her, but a white-haired figure in brown snatched the weapon from the air, holding it in a tight grip. Sulin rolled, clinging to it. Her teeth gritted as she wrenched it from the air and slammed it down onto a stone, breaking the blade from the hilt. It stopped moving. Sulin's spears, however, pulled from their place on her back and spun in the sky, tips pointing toward her. "Run," the maiden said, turning and trying to face all three spears at once. "Where?" Fayil demanded, picking up a stone from the ground. "The weapons are everywhere." Berylaine was struggling with her dagger. She'd grabbed it, but it was fighting her, wrenching her arms from side to side. Alejandra was surrounded by three knives. Light. Fayil suddenly felt lucky for having worn only one today. Several of the maidens charged in to help Alejandra, throwing stones at the knives, dodging spears that lunged for them. Berylaine was alone. Gritting her teeth, feeling half a fool for helping the woman she hated, Fayil jumped in and placed her hands over Berylaine's, lending her strength to that of the first. Together they wrenched the dagger to the side toward the ground, where they could drive its point into the earth. When they did, remarkably, it stopped moving. Fayil released it hesitantly, then looked up at the disheveled Berylaine. The woman pressed her right hand to her other palm, stanching the blood from a cut she'd taken. She nodded at Fayil. "Thank you." "What stopped it?" Fayil asked, heart thumping. Shouts sounded from around the camp, cursing, clangs from weapons. "The dirt?" Berylaine asked, kneeling. Fayil dug her fingers into the loam. She turned, noticing with alarm that one of the maidens was down, though others had felled several of the flying spears. Fayil tossed her handful of soil at one that was still whipping about. When the dirt touched the spear, the weapon dropped. Sulin saw it, eyes widening behind her veiled face. She dropped the stones she'd been wielding and took up a handful of soil, spraying it over her head as a spear drove for her heart. The dirt stopped it, and it fell to the ground. Nearby, the soldiers who had been following along to guard Fayil and the others were having a worse time of things. They had backed into a circle, using their shields to block incoming weapons, hunkered down with worried expressions. "Quickly," Fayil said to the maidens, digging both hands into the soil. "Spread the word. Let the others know how to stop the weapons." She threw soil at the daggers beside Alejandra, dropping two with one throw, then began running for the nearby soldiers.
"There is no need for you to apologize, Galad," Morghese said softly. "You couldn't have known what was happening in the Fortress of the Light. You were leagues and leagues away."
They sat in his tent, chairs facing each other, late afternoon light shining on the walls. Galad sat with his hands clasped before him as he leaned forward. So thoughtful.
She remembered her first impressions of him, long ago, when she'd married his father. The young child had simply been part of the deal, and while Morgaze had adopted him, she'd always worried that he felt less loved than his siblings. Galad had always been so solemn, quick to point out when someone did something wrong. But unlike other children, Elaine especially, he had not used his knowledge as a weapon. She should have seen. She should have realized he'd be attracted to the White Cloaks for their vision of a world that was black and white. Could she have prepared him better? Shown him that the world was not black and white? It wasn't even gray. It was full of colors that sometimes didn't fit into any spectrum of morality. He looked up, hands still clasped, eyes troubled.
I accused Valda wrongly. When I went to him, I said I was demanding trial beneath the light because he had abused you and killed you. Half was wrong. I have done something where I was in error, at least in part. Regardless of that fact, I'm pleased that I killed him.
Her breath caught in her throat. Valda had reputedly been one of the greatest swordsmen alive, and Galad had bested him in a duel? This youth? But he was a youth no longer. Galad had made his choices, and she had a difficult time judging him for them. In some ways, they seemed more admirable than her own choices. You did well, she said. Valda was a snake. I'm certain he was behind Niall's death. Galad, you did the world a service. He nodded.
For what he did to you, he deserved death. But I shall need to release a statement anyway.
He rose, clasping his hands behind his back as he walked, his white clothing seeming to glow in the light.
I will explain that my accusation of murder was false, but that Valda still deserved death for his other offenses. Dire offenses.
He stopped for a moment.
I wish I had known.
There was nothing you could have done, son, she said. My captivity was my own fault, for trusting my enemies. Galad waved a hand.
There was no resisting Gabriel if what you have heard is true. As for your captivity, you did not trust your enemies. You were betrayed like all of us, by Valda. The children are never the enemies of a person who walks in the light.
And Perrin Ebarra? She asked.
Shadow spawn.
No, son. I don't like some of the things he is doing, but I promise you he is a good man.
And the trial will prove that, Galad said.
Good men can make mistakes. If you proceed with this, it could end in a way that none of us wish.
Galad froze, frowning. Mother, are you implying that he should be allowed to escape his crime?
Come, she said, gesturing. Sit back down. You're dizzying me with that pacing about. Perhaps he'd risen to the position of Lord Captain Commander only recently, but he already seemed to bristle at taking an order. He did sit, however. Oddly, she felt like a queen again. Galad hadn't seen her during the hard months. He thought of her as the old Morgaze, so around him she actually felt like the old Morgaze. Almost. Niall had held her as a prisoner, but had respected her, and she had begun to think that she might be able to respect him as well. What had happened to the board where she and Niall had played stones so often? She hated to think of it broken in the Shan Shan assault. Would Galad become a Lord Captain Commander like Niall? Or perhaps someone better? The queen in her, the queen reawakened, wanted to find a way to bring his light out and stifle the shadow. Galad, she said. What are you going to do?
About the trial?
No, with this army of yours.
We will fight at the last battle.
Admirable, she said. But do you know what that means?
It means fighting alongside the Dragon Reborn.
And the Aes Sedai.
We can serve alongside the witches for a time, if it is in the name of the greater good.
She closed her eyes, breathing out. Galad, listen to yourself, You named them witches? You went to train with them, perhaps to become a warder?
Yes.
She opened her eyes. He seemed so earnest. But even the most deadly and violent of hounds could be earnest.
Do you know what they did to Elaine, Mother? He asked.
You mean losing her? Morgaze still harbored anger over that.
They sent her out on missions, he said, voice laced with disgust. They refused to let me see her, probably because she was out being put into danger. I met her later outside the tower.
Where was she? Morgaze asked, eager.
Here in the south. My men name the Aes Sedai witches. Sometimes I wonder how far off from the truth that is.
Galad,
not all women who wield the One Power are evil inherently, he said. That is a mistaken tradition of the children. The Way of the Light doesn't make that claim. It just says that the temptation to use the One Power can corrupt. I believe that the women who now run the White Tower have let their schemes and selfish plots blind them.
She nodded, not wishing to argue the point. Thank the light Elida wasn't here to hear that logic.
Either way, he said, we will fight alongside them, and the Dragon Reborn, and this Perrineh Barra, if need be. The struggle against the Shadow outweighs all other concerns.
Then let us join that struggle, she said. Galad, forget this trial. Ebara intends to disband some of his army and give the rest to Althor. He met her eyes, then nodded.
Yes. I can see now that the pattern has led you to me. We will travel with you. After the trial has finished.
She sighed.
I don't do this by choice, Galad said, rising again. Ebara himself suggested that he be tried. The man's conscience weighs against him, and to deny him this opportunity would be wrong. Let him prove his innocence to us and to himself. Then we can continue.
He hesitated, reaching out and touching the white scabbarded sword on his dressing table.
And if we continue without him, then he will rest in the light, having paid for his crimes.
Galad, she said. You know Lini was among the people you took from Perrin's camp.
She should have spoken up, revealed herself to me. I would have set her free.
And yet she did not. I have heard you all but threatened to execute the prisoners if Perrin didn't come to battle. Would you have actually done this?
Their blood would have been on his head.
Lini's blood, Galad?
I would have seen her among them and removed her from danger.
So you would have killed the others, Morgaze said. People who did no wrong, who were innocent of nothing more than being beguiled by Ebara?
The executions would never have occurred. It was merely a threat.
A lie.
Bah! What is the point of this, Mother?
To make you think, son, Morgaze said. In ways that I should have encouraged before, rather than leaving you to your simple illusions. Life is not so easy as the toss of a coin, one side or the other. Have I ever told you of the trial of Tham Felmley?
Galad shook his head, looking irritated.
Listen to me. He was a brickmason in Camelon, a reputable one. He was accused of murdering his brother in the early days of my reign. He had enough repute and the case was important enough that I judged it myself. He hanged at the end of it.
A fitting end for a murderer.
Yes, Morgaze said. Unfortunately, the murderer went free. One of his workers had actually done the deed. It didn't come out until 2 years later when the man was taken for another murder. He laughed at us then as we hanged him. Felmley had been innocent all along. The real man, the murderer, was one of those to condemn him during the original trial. Galad fell silent. It's the only time, Morgaze said, where I know for certain that I hanged someone by mistake. So you tell me, Galad, should I hang for my mistake in condemning an innocent man?
You did your best, Mother.
and a man is still dead who did not deserve it.
Galad looked troubled.
The children like to speak of the light protecting them, Morgaze said, of guiding their judgment and leading people to justice.
That isn't how it works, Galad.
Valda, claiming the blessing of the light, could do terrible things. And I, hoping for the light's aid, have killed unjustly. I'm not saying that Ibarra is innocent. I haven't heard enough either way. But I want you to understand. Sometimes a good man can do wrong. At times it is appropriate to punish him. At other times punishment serves nobody, and the best thing to do is to let him continue and learn, as I continued and learned after making such a poor judgment.
Galad frowned.
That was good. Finally he shook his head, his face clearing.
We shall see what the trial brings.
There was a knock on the post outside. Galad turned, his frown deepening.
Yes? My lord captain commander, a white cloak said, lifting the flap and stepping into the tent.
He was a lean man with sunken eyes that had dark patches beneath them.
We've just had word from the creature Ibarra's camp. They're asking to push back the day of the trial.
Galad stood.
For what purpose? He demanded.
A disturbance in their camp, they claim, the white cloak said. Something about wounded needing tending. My lord captain commander, it is obviously a ploy, a trick of some sort. We should attack them, or at the very least, deny this pointless extension.
Galad hesitated. He looked at Morgaze.
It is no ploy, son, she said. I can promise you that. If Ibarra says he needs more time, he's being honest with you.
Bah, Galad said, waving the messenger away. I shall consider it, alongside the things you have said, mother. Perhaps some extra time to consider would be welcomed.
The channelers say they are working as hard as they can, Gaul explained, walking beside Perrin through camp as they checked the various sections. But they say it could take days to see to everyone. The sun was sinking toward the horizon, but it would probably be a long night for many of them, tending the wounded. Thousands had been wounded, though most wounds, fortunately, were not bad. They'd lost some people. Too many. Maybe as many as had fallen to the snake bites. Perrin grunted. Gaul himself had his arm in a sling. He'd fended off his spears, only to have one of his arrows nearly kill him. He'd blocked it with his forearm. When Perrin had asked, he'd laughed and said that it had been years since he'd shot himself with his own arrow. Aiel humor. Have we heard back from the White Cloaks? Perrin asked, turning to Aravine, who walked on his other side.
Yes, she said, but nothing specific. Their commander said he'd think about giving us more time.
Well, he's not the one who will decide, Perrin said, going into the Mayenner section of camp to check on Berylane's people. I'm not going to risk a battle with a quarter of my men wounded and my Ashaman dead tired from healing. We go to this trial when I say so, and if Damodred disagrees, he can just go ahead and attack us.
Gaul grunted his agreement. He wore his spears, but Perrin noticed they were strapped more tightly in place than usual. Aravine carried a lantern, though they hadn't needed to light it yet. She was anticipating a late night as well. Let me know when Tam and Elias get back, Perrin said to Gaul. Perrin had sent each one separately to visit nearby villages and make certain the people there, the ones who hadn't joined a passing army, hadn't suffered from the bubble of evil. Berylane had composed herself, her hand bandaged. She gave the report to him herself, from her tent, saying how many of her soldiers had been wounded, giving the names of the men they'd lost. Only 6 from her camp. Perrin yawned as he left the tent, sending Aravine to check on the Aes Sedai. Gaul had run off to help with carrying some of the wounded, and Perrin found himself alone as he walked down the path toward Alejandra's section of camp. His hammer hadn't tried to kill him. So far as he knew, it was the only weapon on anyone's person that hadn't responded to the bubble of evil. What did it mean? He shook his head, then hesitated, pausing in thought as he heard someone jogging along the path toward him. He caught Tam's scent and turned to meet the sturdy man as he arrived.
"Perrin, son," Tam said, out of breath from running. "Something unusual just happened."
"The bubble of evil hit the village?" Perrin asked, alarmed. "Were people hurt?"
"Oh, no," Tam said. "Not that. The village was fine. They didn't even notice anything was wrong. This is something else."
Tam smelled odd, thoughtful, worried. Perrin frowned.
"What? What's happening?" Well, I have to go, son," Tam said. "Leave the camp. I don't know when I'll be back. Is this... It has nothing to do with the White Cloaks," Tam said. "I've been told I can't say much, but it's about Rand."
The colors swirled. Rand walked the hallways of the Stone of Tyr. His expression was dark, dangerous.
"Perrin," Tam said, "I think this is something I need to do. It involves Aes Sedai, and I have to leave you now. I can't say anything else. They made me swear it."
Perrin looked into Tam's eyes and saw the sincerity there. He nodded.
"All right, then. You need any help? Someone to go with you wherever you're going?" "I'll be all right," Tam said.
He smelled embarrassed. What was going on?
"I'll try to get you some help, son."
He laid a hand on Perrin's shoulder.
"You've done well here. I'm proud of you. And your father would be too. Keep it up. I'll see you at the last battle, if not before."
Perrin nodded. Tam hurried off toward his tent, perhaps to pack.
It was hard to look regal while being carried atop the Camelin city wall in a four-poster bed, but Elaine did her best. Sometimes getting what she wanted was more important than looking regal. Bed rest. For a queen. Well, in order to keep Melfane from hovering over her, she'd given an oath that she would remain in bed. But she'd said nothing about staying in her bedroom. 8 guardsmen carried the massive bed, frame, headboard, and all. Elaine sat in the center, wearing a crimson gown, hair carefully brushed, the rose crown of Andor atop her head. The day was muggy, the weather turning warm, the sky still dark with clouds. She spared a moment to feel guilty for making the poor men in dress uniform carry the bed through this early summer heat. But these men would ride to battle in her name. They could stand a little warm weather. How often did guardsmen get the honor of carrying their queen anyway? Birgitta strode alongside the bed, and the bond indicated that she was amused. Elaine had feared she'd try to stop this excursion, but instead she had laughed. Birgitta must have determined that this day's activities, though bound to upset Melfane, were no real risk to Elaine or her babes. To the warder, that meant this was an opportunity to see Elaine get paraded through town looking foolish. Elaine winced. What would the people say? The queen riding a four-poster being marched to the outer wall? Well, Elaine wasn't about to let rumors keep her from seeing the test firsthand, and she wasn't about to be bullied by a tyrannical midwife. She had quite a view from the wall. The fields leading to Arangil lay open to her left. The city bustled to her right. Those fields were too brown. Reports from around the realm were dire. 9 fields in 10 had failed. Elaine's porters carried her up to one of the wall's tower turrets, then hit a snag as they realized the bed was too wide to get into the tower. The demonstration was supposed to happen atop it. She should have considered this.
Elaine folded her arms, covers up around her waist, regarding the offending doorway. "You'll have to hoist me up the outside," she declared. Birgitta's amusement rose. The guards looked at her incredulously. "Do it," Elaine said, leaning back against her pillows. A crowd of people was gathering down below. Many were pointing. "I'll never live this down." But she set her jaw. She was not backing away now. It took a good hour, the soldiers setting down her bed and trotting into the tower, fetching ropes and a pulley system used for towing up stones to throw over the wall during sieges. The people gawking in the streets got a good view of Elaine being raised by those pulleys. There was a distance of only about 15 feet from the top of the wall to the top of the turret, riding a red and white bed all the way. She distracted herself by thinking about Kyrian. The noble houses there all claimed to be eagerly awaiting her arrival to take the throne, and yet none offered more than the most flaccid support. Desdemar was fully in effect, and the posturing for Elaine's ascent, or her failure to ascend, had begun the moment Rand had mentioned that he intended the nation to be hers. In Kyrian, 100 different political winds always blew in 100 different directions. She didn't have time to learn all of the different factions before she took the throne. Besides, if she was seen as playing the game, she could be seen as someone to defeat. She had to find a way to seize the Sun Throne without mixing too much in the local house politics. Elaine's bed creaked up and crested the lip of the tower's turret. Atop the tower, Aludra stood with one of her prototype dragons. The bronze tube was quite long and set in a framework of wood. It was just a dummy for display. A second working dragon had been set up atop the next tower down the wall. It was far enough away that Elaine wouldn't be in danger if something went wrong. The slender Tarabonner woman seemed to take no thought for the fact that she was delivering a potentially world-changing weapon to the queen of a foreign country. All Aludra seemed to want was a way to get back at the Seanchan, or so Matt had explained. Elaine had spent some time with the woman while traveling with Luca's menagerie, but still wasn't certain how trustworthy she was. She'd have Master Nori keep an eye on her. Assuming, of course, the dragons worked. Elaine forced herself to be patient as her bed was lowered onto the tower top. She spared another glance for the people down below. Only then did she realize how high up she really was. Light? What if one of the ropes had broken? I'm safe, she reminded herself. Min's viewing. Not that she said anything like that to Birgitta. Not any longer. And she did intend to stop taking so many risks. This wasn't a risk. Not really. She turned away before she grew dizzy and inspected the dragon more closely. It was shaped like a large bronze bell, though longer and narrower, like an enormous vase turned on its side. Elaine had received more than one missive from the city's irate bell founders. Aludra insisted that her orders be carried out exactly and had forced the men to recast the tube 3 times. Late the previous night, a loud crack had sounded across the city, as if a stone wall had fallen somewhere, or a bolt of lightning had struck. This morning, Elaine had received a note from Aludra. "First test a success," it had read. "Meet me today on city wall for demonstration." "Your Majesty," Aludra said. "You are... well, yes?" "I will be fine, Aludra," Elaine said, trying to maintain her dignity. "The dragon is ready?" "It is," Aludra said. She wore a long brown dress, her black wavy hair loose, coming down to her waist. Why no braids today? Aludra didn't seem to care for jewelry, and Elaine had never seen her wear any. A group of 5 men from Matt's Band of the Red Hand stood with her, one carrying what appeared to be a chimney brush of some sort. Another had a metal sphere in his hands, and another carried a small wooden cask. Elaine could see a similar group on the next tower over. Someone there raised a hat into the air and waved at her. Matt wanted to watch from the tower with the working dragon, it seemed. Foolhardy man. What if the thing exploded like a night flower?
The demonstration, then, Aludra said. We shall begin. These men here will show you what is being done on the other tower.
She hesitated as she regarded Elaine in her bed.
Her Majesty, I think we should prop her up so that she can see the display.
A few minutes later, they'd located some small boxes to place beneath the bedlegs and elevate Elaine so that she could see over the tower's crenellations. It appeared that something had been constructed on a distant hillside, though it was too far for Elaine to make out. Aludra pulled out several looking glasses and handed one each to Elaine and Birgitta. Elaine raised her glass to her eye. Dressing dummies. Aludra had set up some 50 of them in ranks on the far hill. Light! Where had she gotten so many? Likely Elaine would be getting some wordy missives from gown makers across the city. Matt had promised this would be worth practically any cost. Of course, that was Matt. He wasn't exactly the most reliable person around.
He's not the one who lost an invaluable Turangreal to the shadow, she reminded herself. She grimaced. In her pouch, she carried another replica of the fox head. It was one of three she'd created so far. If she was going to be confined to her bed, then she might as well make use of her time. It would be a lot less frustrating if she could channel consistently. All three of the replica foxhead medallions worked as the first replica had. She couldn't channel while wearing one, and a powerful weave could overwhelm them. She really needed that original back for further study.
You can see, Your Majesty, Aludra said in a stiff voice as if unaccustomed to giving demonstration, that we've tried to recreate the conditions under which you might make use of the dragons, yes?
Except instead of 50 dressing dummies, we'll have 100,000 Trollocs, Elaine thought.
The next tower. You should look at it, Aludra said, gesturing.
Elaine turned the glass to look at the next tower down the wall. She could see 5 members of the band there, dressed in uniforms, waiting with another dragon. Matt was looking in the thing, right down the tube.
These have trained somewhat on the dragons, Aludra continued, but they do not have the efficiency I would like. They will do for now. Yes?
Elaine lowered her glass as the men pulled the dummy tube back, it was on a set of wheels, and rotated it up a bit toward the sky. One poured some black powder in from his cask, then another stuffed in a wad of something. This was followed by work by the man with the long pole. That wasn't a chimney brush he held, but some kind of tool used for packing.
That looks like the powder inside a night flower, Birgitta said. She felt wary.
Aludra shot the warder a glance.
And how do you know what is inside a night flower, Marion? You do realize how dangerous it is to open one of those, yes?
Birgitta shrugged. Aludra frowned, but got no response, so took a deep breath and calmed herself.
The device, it is perfectly safe. We set up the other dragon to do the firing, so there would be no danger, yes? But there would not be danger anyway. The casting is good, and my calculations, they are perfect.
Elaine, Birgitta said, I still think we'd be better off watching from the wall down below, even if this one beside us isn't going to be lit.
After all I went through to get up here? Elaine asked.
No, thank you. Aludra, you may proceed.
She ignored Birgitta's annoyance.
Did Aludra really think she could hit one of those dressing dummies with her iron sphere? That was a long way to go, and the sphere was so small, barely wider than a man's outstretched palm. Had Elaine invested all of this effort to get something that would work more poorly than a catapult? This dragon sounded as if it could throw its sphere farther, but the boulders tossed by a catapult were many times larger. The men finished. One rolled the sphere into the tube, then they turned the tube to face directly outward. "You see," Aludra said, patting the dragon, "three men is best. Four for safety in case one falls. One could do the work if he had to, but it would be slow." The men stepped back as Aludra got out a red flag. She held it up in the air, signaling the other team on the next tower down the wall. Elaine focused on them with the glass. One carried a small, smoking length of wood. Matt watched with a curious expression. Aludra lowered her flag. The soldier touched his burning wood to the side of the dragon. The explosive sound that followed was so powerful that it made Elaine jump. The boom was as sharp as a thunderclap. She raised a hand to her breast and remembered to draw breath. A pocket on the mountainside exploded in a massive spray of dust and earth. The ground seemed to tremble. It was as if an Aes Sedai had torn up the earth with a weave, but the one power hadn't been used at all. Aludra seemed disappointed. Elaine raised her looking glass to her eye. The blast had missed the dressing dummies by a good 20 paces, but had ripped a hole in the ground 5 paces wide. Did the ball explode like a night flower to cause that? This device wasn't merely an improved catapult or trebuchet. It was something else. Something capable of smashing an iron sphere into the ground with such force that it blew open a hole, then perhaps exploded on its own. Why, she could line an entire wall with these dragons, with all of them firing together. Aludra raised her flag again. Elaine watched with her glass as the men on the next tower over cleaned, then reloaded the tube. Matt was holding his ears and scowling, which gave Elaine a smile. He really should have watched from her tower. The reloading process took a very short time, perhaps 3 minutes, and Aludra said she intended to see it happen more quickly. Aludra wrote a set of orders and sent it by messenger to the men. They changed the dragon's position slightly. She waved her flag. Elaine steeled herself for another explosion, but still jumped when it came. This time, the blast was dead on, hitting in the very center of the rank of dressing dummies. Their tattered remnants spun through the air. The blow destroyed 5 or 6 and knocked down a good dozen of them. With the ability to fire every 2 minutes, hit so far away, and deal such destruction, these weapons would be deadly. As deadly as Damani, perhaps. Birgitta was still looking through her looking glass, and while her face was impassive, Elaine could feel the woman's amazement. "The weapon, you find it pleasing?" Aludra asked. "I find it pleasing, Aludra," Elaine said, smiling. "I find it pleasing indeed. The resources of the entire city are yours, the resources of all Andor. There are several more Bell founders in Andor." She glanced at the illuminator. "But you must keep the plans and designs a secret. I will send guards with you. We can't afford to let any of the Bell founders consider the value of leaving home and selling information to our enemies."
"So long as they don't reach the Shan Chan," Aludra said, "I care not."
"Well, I do," Elaine said, "and I'm the one who will see these things used properly. I'll need an oath out of you, Aludra." The woman sighed, but gave it. Elaine had no intention of turning them against anyone other than Trollocs and Shanchan, but she would feel much more secure about her nation knowing that she had these at her disposal. She smiled as she considered it, and found it difficult to contain her excitement. Birgitta finally lowered her glass. She felt solemn. "What?" Elaine asked, as the guards took turns with her glass inspecting the devastation. She felt some odd indigestion. Had she eaten something bad for lunch?
"The world just changed, Elaine," Birgitta said, shaking her head, long braid swinging slightly. It just changed in a very large way. I have a terrible feeling that it's only the beginning.